So let's go back into the text now. So one point we'll try and clarify here before we go on to the fifth outline, the way of asserting object possessors, is here in the Prasangika it says, in this context it is accepted that true cessations are necessarily ultimate truths, whereas in the Svatantrika we saw that they are considered to be conventional truths. So why the difference? This book here says something, but very brief, and I don't think it really clarifies. But let's have a look at it anyway. It says here on page 941, true cessations are the element of attributes. And then Zhang Yang Shaper comments on that. He says, through the way that the four truths are included in the two truths, i.e. the first, second and fourth are conventional and the third ultimate, it is understood that true cessations are the elements of attributes, that is, the emptiness of inherent existence. But maybe what can clarify a little bit more, let's see, are definitions of true cessation according to Svatantrika and Prasangika. And this comes from my studies from many years ago. In Prasangika, a true cessation is defined as a separation from an obstruction, which is its respective object of abandonment of the uninterrupted path. So it's a separation from an obstruction, which is its respective object of abandonment of the uninterrupted path. So it's a separation of an obstruction, which is its respective object of abandonment of the uninterrupted path. So it's a separation from something we've abandoned through uninterrupted path. And of course, uninterrupted path here is when we are having a direct realization of emptiness. And that direct realization of emptiness is necessarily eliminating something. So in the next moment after an uninterrupted path, we have what's called the path of release or a liberated path. And that's when we have the true cessation, that we are realizing emptiness directly. Through that realization, we are eliminating some object of abandonment, some portion of ignorance or mental afflictions. And that separation of having eliminated that is the true cessation. So therefore, it's considered to be emptiness. In the Svatantrika, Svatantrika, so we're still Majjhamika, Svatantrika, true cessation is defined as a truth of the completely pure class. So we talk about two classes of phenomena, thoroughly afflicted and completely pure. Thoroughly afflicted phenomena are things that sort of keep us in samsara, and completely pure class are things that help us to get out of samsara. So a true cessation is a truth of a completely pure class, distinguished by being qualified by four attributes of cessation. The four attributes. So it's a truth of the completely pure class, distinguished by being qualified by four attributes. And the four attributes, within the Four Noble Truths, if any of you have studied them, each of the Four Noble Truths has four attributes. You can divide it into what's called the 16 aspects. So the four attributes of cessation, truth of cessation, is cessation, pacification, auspicious highness, and definite emergence. So here they define true cessation as that. A truth of the completely pure class, distinguished by being qualified by the four attributes of cessation, pacification, auspicious highness, and definite emergence. So they're really equating it with the third noble truth. And perhaps because it's then qualified by those four attributes, it's not an emptiness, because some of those attributes not just talking about the separation from the object of abandonment. So that's my speculation, is because then true cessation includes all of those four attributes. Therefore, it's not just an emptiness. It's not an emptiness. It's a conventional truth. But that's my speculation. So anyway, that may or may not help. Okay, let's move on. And I think from memory as well is when I studied this true cessations many years ago, what I remember was that a true cessation is also considered to be the emptiness of the mind on that liberated path, the moment after we've eliminated something. But that's just my vague memory, which may or may not be accurate, because it was more than 10 years ago. Okay, let's have a look at object possessors. So again, in Prasangika, the first part of this is the illustration of person. So here, the mere I, which is imputed in dependence on the five aggregates, is accepted to be the illustration of person. So to talk a little bit more about that, I'd like to begin and talk a little bit, read from this book again, and then there's a few things I want to add to this that may be useful. So here, this is on page 41, and this is again a comment from the authors, Daniel Kozol, Craig Preston. So it's not from Jung Yum Shaper, but it's their comment. This is what they say. The Prasangika designation of the person aptly demonstrates why it might be best to approach Prasangika only after having considered the other schools, since it is a subtle view and one that follows upon the refutation of the others. Prasangika is considered all of the possibilities mentioned above to be indefensible, meaning all of the other illustrations of person that we saw earlier, they would reject, because they're all pointing to something, means that there's something findable that's the person, be it the mental consciousness, the continuum aggregates, mind bases of all. They would refute all of those as the illustration of the person, because that would necessarily imply inherent existence, that it's findable. Since they are all based upon the assumption of the true existence of the person, that when sought among the bases of designation, such as the mind and body, can be found. Rather, Prasangika say, an analytical search will not result in the finding of anything that exists independently. All things are empty. Prasangika also generally uphold the conventions of the world. Since the mind basis of all is something unknown to ordinary persons, we should be skeptical of its existence. The mere I is just that. The person is a name. It is a nominal designation made on the basis of the aggregates, but it is not itself any of the aggregates. As we saw in the last chapter, the various possibilities outlined above assume substantial existence. This is precisely what is wrong with them. Sometimes it is said that for Prasangikas, the subtle mental consciousness can also be designated as the person. The subtle mental consciousness certainly can give rise to the thought of I, as long as it is understood that the I is merely designated in dependence on the mental consciousness rather than being the mental consciousness. There is no problem. The mind basis of all and some other entities that will be discussed below, however, are unnecessary additions that go beyond worldly conventions. So, to go a little bit more on that, one of the reasons we talk about the illustration of the person is, again, that continuity, sort of what goes from life to life. And as we've seen, many of the Buddhist philosophical systems say it's the mental consciousness that's the person, the one that goes from life to life. And so what is the Prasangika answer of what goes from life to life? And of course, here we see the answer is mere I. But even answering that question in that way can be misleading, because the question itself is a little bit loaded. Because when we say what goes from life to life, we're asking, what is the thing that moves from life to life? And of course, Prasangika would say, technically the answer would be nothing. Nothing goes. As we saw briefly the other day, even when we talk about the physical world and we don't look closely, it appears as if there are things moving through time. This pen appears to be more or less the same pen that was here yesterday, more or less the same pen tomorrow. So it seems like this pen is moving through time. Is that actually what's going on? Is there anything that moves through time in the physical world, according to science? No, nothing. Because it's just impermanence. There's constant change. So actually, even if we're technically correct, there's not one single physical thing in the universe moving through time. There's just change. But of course, and this is in line with Prasangika, in that flow of change, we label things to understand the flow. You know, we label pen because that's useful to understand the flow. It's helpful for us. As long as we're understanding that it's just merely labeled, then there's no problem. The problem comes, according to Prasangika, that all the lower schools fall into is that they go more than that. That they go, it must be findable. There must be a thing there which is the pen. But then Prasangika would go, well, hang on, then you run into problems here. And this is exactly what Nagarjuna does in his text, the Mulamajjhimika Karika. He says, you accept things exist from their own sign? What about cause and effect? How does that work? Agent and action, how does that work? And it's complete logical absurdity. If we're saying that there are things moving through time, then we have a lot of logical absurdities. Things cannot work. And so similarly here, when Prasangika answers mere I, what goes from life to life, it's a bit awkward to even say that because the question is sort of loaded. You know, what goes from life to life? And then people hear me like, oh, thank God, there's something that is going from this life to the next. This near eye, I can hold on to that. And then, of course, we get a wrong idea. So to try and understand what we mean by near eye, we can talk about, of course, the continuum of the mind. And then, of course, let's say this is the current life. So in this life, of course, associated with that is a body. Let's say that's the present moment. So the person who exists in the present moment is a person merely labelled on the mind that is present now and the body that is present now. So the person who exists now, the mere I, and mere here means merely labelled person, is the person labelled on the basis of the mind that is present now and the body that's present now. And of course, in this life, we have that the person at any point in life is the person merely labelled on the basis of the body and the mind that is present at that point. So that's the near eye. When we come to the point of death, we go through a death process. And in the first four stages of the death process, we still have this coarse mind active and we still have this coarse body is still functioning. But they're shutting down. So in the first four stages of the death process, the person who's undergoing the process is the person labelled on whatever the coarse mind and body is present at that time. At the end of those four stages, the coarse body is shut down. The coarse mind, which is based on the coarse body, is shut down. But then the mind becomes subtle. And then we have a subtle body is active, the subtle body or the subtle energies in the body. So over the next three stages, the subtle body and subtle mind are active. So the person who's undergoing the process is a person labelled on the subtle mind and subtle body that's present at that time. So, of course, here, even though there's person labelled or existing, that person, of course, is no longer human. Because, of course, body is finished. We only have subtle body, subtle mind. So this person, i.e. Being, is not human anymore, but is still person. And then, after the end of the next three stages, the subtle body and subtle mind have shut down. So we end up with a very subtle mind and a very subtle wind energy, which is the subtle, very subtle body. So that last stage, the person is labelled on the very subtle mind and very subtle body. This is called the mind of clear light, mind of death. Then, at that point, the mind disconnects from the coarse body and enters into what's called the Bardo, intermediate period, where we take on a subtle body and a subtle mind. So the Bardo being in that period is a person labelled on a subtle body, subtle mind. So again, not human. But then at the end of the Bardo, if that mind connects with a fertilized egg in the womb, we have, again, a coarse body and the beginnings of a coarse mind. So then we have the person of the next life. Again, now it's human because it's based, labelled on the basis of a more coarse mind and a coarse body, the beginnings of a coarse body. So at all points in this process, we have mere I labelled on that continuum. So that's what it means when Prasangika say the mere eye goes from life to life. They're not saying there's a thing, a mere eye that doesn't really change, that's moving from life to life. They're not saying that. So this is the assertion.
What happens when death occurs instantaneously? Those first four stages occur instantaneously?
No. The first four stages, particularly where the coarse body's shutting down, depending on the type of death you're undergoing, could take days or weeks. I mean, a person could be hovering in those stages for a long time.
But if it's instantaneous due to accident?
Yeah, then because we're talking about the coarse body, the heartbeat and the brain, so that would be, very quick, in a matter of seconds, it would all finish. Yeah, so it could be long, short, depending on the type of death.
There's two verses in Magadrina's praise to satisfying sentient beings that seem particularly.
Sure.
Just as independent on a mirror, full of image of one's face appears, the face did not move into the mirror, yet without it there is no image of the face. Likewise, aggregates recompose in a new existence, yet the wise always understand that no one is born in another existence, nor does someone transfer to such existence.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's the thing is that particularly a lot of the non-Buddhist schools are really trying to hold on to something that is that thing that transfers. And of course, they accept that this body collapses, so they can't be pointing somewhere there. A lot of the lower Buddhist schools point to the mental consciousness, and some of the non-Buddhists then grasp onto this unitary, independent, unchanging self, this Atman, that is the thing. So, right, yeah.
Can you say something about the idea, the concept of time within what you've just done there?
So again,
it looks as though time is happening.
Right. But again, time, like person, like flower, according to Prasangika, is merely labeled. So again, it's a concept developed to describe reality. So to make sense of this, we develop concepts like pen and flower and person and so forth to make sense. But of course, to make sense also, we have this concept of time to explain change, for example. And even change is a concept. So therefore, we can talk about time, but it's not some objective, independent thing. It's also a concept.
Because you can see change happening in your body, for example, as you go through this life.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And again, change is a concept that we've developed to describe. And time is a concept we've developed to describe. Time that makes some meaning out of what we experience. And for prasangika, therefore, it functions. So we're not saying we just fabricated it and it doesn't exist. So prasangika are not saying we fabricated that this is a flower and it doesn't exist. In fact, they're saying exact opposite. They're saying because this is a construct merely labeled, therefore it exists and functions. This,
say that again.
Yeah. Because see, for the lower schools, for something to function, it must necessarily exist from its own side. It must necessarily have its own unique nature for it to function. Otherwise, it's just some fabrication that doesn't really exist. So for the lower schools, for something to function, it must be truly existent. And that's how we tend to intuitively see the world. For us, that must exist from its own side to be able to function. Otherwise, it's just something we've fabricated mentally and doesn't really exist. Prasangika is saying the exact opposite. That prasangika is saying, even though that's how things appear to us, that they appear to exist independently and function, that's not how things are. And so for prasangika, and this is a measure of if we've got the correct view of emptiness according to prasangika. This is one measure of whether we really appreciate the prasangika view, is if we can get to the point whereby we understand that because things are empty of findable inherent existence, they can appear and function. And because they function, they must be empty of inherent existence. If we can have these ideas together, it's said that we have the correct view of prasangika. This is not so easy, because even great masters like Tsongkhapa, in some of his texts and other masters' texts, they say someone who has this idea that functionality and emptiness are two sides of a coin is amazing, they say. It's completely amazing to have this idea together. So it's not easy to get to. And we can talk, while I'm on that point, we talked about the two extremes. For prasangika, and of course all the Buddhist philosophical systems say they've got the middle way, and they posit what the two extremes are for them. For prasangika, the extreme of existence is grasping onto inherent existence. The extreme of non-existence or nihilism is that nothing exists at all. Now, to overcome these two extremes in prasangika, how we overcome the extreme of inherent grasping onto inherent existence, of course, is realizing everything's empty of inherent existence. So emptiness is the antidote. Is that when we come to realize emptiness according to prasangika, that everything's empty of inherent existence, we can overcome this extreme. But because this middle way within prasangika is very subtle, I think I mentioned this last weekend already, is that when we start to investigate this and we start to establish the idea of emptiness, one of the most common things that happens as a beginner, we flip to the other extreme. Because for us, now, if things are not inherent existing, if they don't exist from their own side, they don't exist at all. So when we start to understand emptiness a little bit and undermine that, then often the most common thing is that we just flip to the other extreme and we go, nothing really exists. And You hear that a lot. People who've heard a little bit about emptiness here, you know, often you hear people say, oh, it doesn't matter because everything's empty. No, that's very common. Oh, it doesn't matter because everything's empty. This is flipped to the extreme of nihilism. We haven't understood emptiness. All we've done is we've wrongly understood emptiness to imply nothing really exists. So we're just stuck here. So how do we overcome this extreme is by reflecting on dependent arising. In particular here, and of course all Buddhist schools accept that dependent arising, that things are dependent, but here, in particular in Prasangika, to reflect on the idea that things are dependent on labelling and imputation, that they're merely labelled. Because if we can reflect on that, we can overcome the extreme of non-existence or nihilism. That in fact things do exist as merely labelled. So normally, these are the two antidotes for these two extremes. But also in the Tennis texts, they say that another measure that we're really appreciating this is the opposite. Is that if we can appreciate a functioning world, if we really understand dependent arising, we'll understand nothing exists inherently. And if we really understand emptiness, we can understand that doesn't mean nihilism, that actually there's a functioning world. So that's also a measure. That's one of the things in Prasangika that's often mentioned, particularly in that tenets text, is that that is also the case. And that's really a measure that we're very progressing very well in the view, is that merely by seeing things that reinforces our understanding there must be empty of inherent existence. And by understanding emptiness, that reinforces our idea there can be a functioning world. Hence the idea everything arises out of emptiness as the sort of poetic way of saying that. So again, emptiness is not a thing and everything's popping out of that. But what it means again is because of emptiness, a functioning world can appear. That's what it really means, this idea. So I wanted to mention one more thing on that. Because if things inherently existed, if this existed from its own side as a flower or a plant, if that was its own unique nature to be a flower or a plant, it couldn't function. It couldn't change, you couldn't create it, because it has a unique nature of being a flower. That's it. That's what it is. But because it doesn't have its own unique nature of being a flower from its own side, therefore you can create it, it can function, and it can be destroyed. So as I mentioned earlier, if we really appreciate impermanence at a very subtle level, not just this sort of clunky idea that we talked about that, you know, things are momentary and in this moment we get something produced. This is sort of a fairly superficial idea of impermanence. If we can really get down to appreciate the deepest understanding of impermanence, that there's just flow of change, then how can there be something there existing from its own side? There is no thing there from its own side. There's just this flow of change. So sometimes in the Prasangika text, it says that if we actually can realize impermanence directly, we're this close to realizing emptiness. This close.
It's a very nice text, I think, the two principal aspects of the path might explain that relationship very nicely.
I'm interested in the use of the word functionality.
Yeah.
You're suggesting that
well, functionality just means functioning thing, impermanent phenomena, as opposed to permanent phenomena, which are not functioning things. So emptiness is not a functioning thing because it's permanent, like true cessation, like uncompounded space and so forth, they're permanent.
Yeah,
Not in that sense. They don't perform a function because they're not created by causes and conditions. It's only Vaibhashika that assert that permanent things are functioning things. Everyone else says there's two types of phenomena, functioning things, which are impermanent, and uncompounded phenomena, which are not functioning things. Because functioning thing means basically created through causes and conditions. Okay. Right, so let's move on then. Oh, no, I was going to actually talk about, I'll be quite brief. So on this mere eye, remember one of the reasons that all of the Buddhist schools posit the illustration of person is also the fact, this idea of karmic imprints. You know, what is the continuity that allows for actions created earlier to be experienced later? And so we saw that the continuum, the mental consciousness, the mind basis of all in the Chittamatra, that's where they say these karmic imprints are deposited. But in Prasangika, there's no mention about karmic imprints. So how do they explain it? At the risk of totally confusing people, I like to sort of at least present their idea briefly. And actually, what you find is the Vaibhashika also, in general, don't talk about karmic imprints. They don't use the idea of karmic imprints when they talk about karma in Vaibhashika. In fact, it's mentioned a little bit here. So we'll see that. So this is on page 263 in this book here. Because of being produced, disintegratedness, so this is the Prasangika explanation of how imprints work, is the idea of disintegratedness. Because of being produced, disintegratedness is a functioning thing. Although many eons pass after action has ceased, effects issue forth. Even though, and here he talks about other concepts that are used by Vaibhashika and the lower schools, even though acquisition, which is one of the concepts that Vaibhashika use for describing how karma works, so even though acquisition, mental continuums in which predispositions are infused, so that's karmic imprints, so that's most of the other schools accept that. So even though acquisition and the karmic imprints and non-wastage is also a thing that's used by some Vaibhashikas to explain this, do not exist. So this is what it says here. So the commentary on that says the following. Because of being produced by causes, disintegratedness is a functioning thing. And since it is able to produce effects directly, although many eons have passed after the cessation of actions that have all the features of having been done and accumulated, the disintegratedness of the action is posited as the producer of effects without there being any need to posit upon analyzing the object a thing that connects an effect with an action such as, and the three that is being refuted by Prasangika is acquisition that is produced by action. So that's something that Vaibhashika say is actually produced by an action, an acquisition which somehow then connects the action to the person. The continuum of mental consciousness in which predispositions are infused, so we're rejecting that, the idea of karmic imprints. And non-wastage of actions, a substantial entity that is like a seal witnessing alone, etc. So what they're basically saying, there's a lot more there, but we won't go into it, so, because it's a huge topic. But what they're saying is that the fact that something ceases is something that's produced. And because it's something produced, it can produce something further. So this is sort of the basic simple idea of disintegratedness. So actually for Prasangika then, past and future are impermanent, are functioning things because of this idea. So they're not like the lower schools, past and future are not a mere negation, a mere lack. They actually are produced. So this is sort of the simple idea. And so since an action, when an action is completed, it produces the what's called the disintegratedness, the next moment. And so because it produces that, then there's a continuity. And so they say then, well, why do we need to talk about this acquisition and non-wastage and imprints? Why do we need to bring in these ideas when we have the cause and effect already happening? So that's good enough. So that's the Prasangika idea. But again, you can look at that in more detail later. I don't want to go into any more detail now. So that's just how the Prasangika is saying is that the Vaibhashika have this acquisition and non-wastage to describe how it's connected. Most of the lower other schools all say that when an action is completed, that deposits this karmic imprint on the continuum. Whereas Prasangika say, well, we don't need to talk about that because when the action comes to an end, then that disintegratedness or the finishing of the action is like before, is produces an effect. So there's cause and effect happening. And so that's good enough for us. So that's their explanation anyway.
Is it saying that disintegratedness immediately creates another moment of disintegratedness?
Yes, exactly.
Rather than there's action at a remote...
Yeah, so what they're saying is that when an action comes to an end, rather than there being an absence of an action, that because each moment in that action produces another moment, the next moment happens to be the fact that the action is finished, it still goes on. Yes, so that's their point, that in every moment there's still a continuum. Yeah, that's their idea. Okay, let's move on.
Can I just ask, what does a seal witnessing alone
mean? It's a Vaibhashika assertion. I can't remember. I did study this. It's in Abhidharma Kosha. So if you want to know about karma and Vaibhashika, both acquisition and non-wastage, I think they're two different sub-skills in Vaibhashika, assert that. I think actually there may be some more explanation in here, but certainly in Abhidharma Kosha, you may find that there's a footnote in here talking about that. If not, it's certainly something in here. But in Abhidharma Kosha, that text, you'll find a lot of description about. I remember studying this some years ago, this acquisition and non-wastage. So you'll get a quite an extensive explanation about what those ideas mean. Okay, let's move on. There are two types of awareness, valid cognition and non-valid cognition. So remember here, there's a difference. So remember, valid cognition from Sanskrit is pramana. And pra, for all the lower schools, for them, that means new. So a valid cognition has to be new, meaning only the first moment. Any subsequent moment is not valid cognition, it's subsequent. So it's a non-valid cognition. Here, of course, in Prasangika, pramana, pra, is interpreted as prime. So therefore, valid cognition does not have to be, is not just the first moment. So actually, a subsequent cognition is necessarily a valid cognition for Prasangika. There are two types of valid cognition, valid perception and valid inference. Self-cognizing perception is not accepted. So in Prasangika, they don't accept this idea of self-cognizer. Their idea, and this is talked a little bit more about in Shantideva, he talks about this idea a little bit, that basically we don't need to posit self-cognizer because it's simply through association that we can know the mind that knows the object. So that's sort of their interpretation, that the mind illuminates itself as well as objects, so we don't need to talk about self-cognizer. A sense consciousness in the continuum of a sentient being is necessarily a mistaken consciousness. So again, for Prasangika, the way things appear to our sense consciousness is mistaken because things appear to inherently exist and they do not exist in that way. So for them, unlike all the lower schools, a sense consciousness is necessarily mistaken. Whereas for lower schools, it's not mistaken, a valid one, you know. Because the object is appearing in as inherently existent and it exists in that way for all the lower schools. Mental consciousness and yogic perception can either be mistaken or non-mistaken. Oh, sorry, back up. I missed one point even before this. Person is necessarily a non-associated compositional factor. What that means is when we talk about functioning things, we can divide them into three categories. We can divide them into material things, form, consciousness, and then the third category is what's called non-associated compositional factors. Because a person is not consciousness and it's not matter, it's not form. And non-associated compositional factors, person is there because person is something merely labelled on the basis of body and mind. But also in here we have things like time, imprints from lower schools, they talk about imprints. What else is there? Actual impermanence itself is here. Birth and all that. These are all non-associated compositional factors. So that's all it's really saying here, is that person is not really, it's not a physical thing, it's not a mental thing, it's this non-associated compositional factor. Okay, go back and to where we were. So mental consciousness and yogic perception can either be mistaken or non-mistaken. So here, yogic perception can either be mistaken or non-mistaken. Remember in the lower schools, I think they all said yogic perception is necessarily non-mistaken. What an implication here is that an ordinary being, someone who's not realized emptiness, can realize subtle impermanence. So that realization of subtle impermanence for an ordinary being who hasn't realized emptiness is mistaken, because it's the permanence of the object is still, it's still appearing to exist inherently. The lower schools, I think the Chittamatra Svatantrika, because they say that yogic perception is necessarily non-mistaken, what they're really saying is that someone who's realizing impermanence is only someone who's realized emptiness, not before. So for Prasangika, their assertion is that you can, an ordinary being can realize subtle impermanence. An ordinary being can realize this lack of self-sufficient, substantially existent self. And both of those direct realizations are mistaken because the object is appearing to inherently exist. Now, here's an interesting one. There are two types of valid perception: conceptual valid perception and non-conceptual valid perception. So remember, for all the lower schools, perception is necessarily non-conceptual, because perception is about the direct perceiver. Remember where the word perception here is more about the object. So to answer that, to why we can have conceptual valid perception in Prasangika, we got two illustrations here. The second moment of an inference realizing sound to be impermanent is a conceptual valid perception. Why? Because the second moment of a valid cognizer is valid cognizer. And in the second moment of realizing sound to be impermanent, we are no longer relying on a reason. We're just remembering the previous moment. So because we're not relying on a reason to generate that, it's not an inference anymore. So for them, it would be a conceptual valid perception for Prasangika. So for all the lower schools, it's neither a conceptual perception or a valid perception, because perception is necessarily non-conceptual and it must be the first moment. And the similar here, a remembering consciousness that is factually concordant with a memory of blue generated through being induced by a sense perception apprehending blue. So again, the same idea here, is that because it's no longer relying on any reason, because it's a subsequent cognizer, it's still a valid cognizer and it's conceptual. And of course, an illustration of a non-conceptual valid perception is a sense perception apprehending form, as with the lower schools. But of course, here it's not just the first moment. All subsequent moments are also non-conceptual valid perception. Next point. If it is a valid perception, it does not necessarily have a perceptible object. So again, here's a little bit of a technical point, but it's an implication of their view. Because if it is a yogic perception, it necessarily does not have a perceptible object. This is so because perceptible object and manifest object are equivalent. So if we're having a yogic perception of impermanence, selfness as a person, or emptiness, those three objects are not manifest objects, they're hidden objects. So therefore, it's not a perceptible object. So this is sort of a little technical point here again. And again, based on their idea of pramana, if it is a subsequent cognition, it is necessarily a valid perception. And they posit four types of inference. I think the lower schools only talked about three. They talk about inference through the power of the fact, inference through renown, inference through an example, and inference through belief. And it says here, inference through renown and inference through example are included in inference through the power of the fact. Again, they, yeah, nothing really to say there. If it is a valid cognition, it is not necessarily non-mistaken with respect to its determined object, because an inference realizing sound to be impermanent is a consciousness that is mistaken with respect to the impermanence of sound. So again, the same idea as before, because it's not non-mistaken because impermanence of sound is appearing to be inherently existent. So non-mistaken for lower schools necessarily means wrong consciousness. But here, for Prasangika, it can still be a valid cognition, even though, so this is a valid cognition with respect to the impermanence of sound, but it's mistaken with respect to that appearing to inherently exist. It's mistaken with respect to that. And this last point, let's read it out and comment. It says, if it is a consciousness, it necessarily realizes its object of comprehension, because the generic image of the horns of a rabbit is the object of comprehension of a conception apprehending the horns of a rabbit. And the generic image of permanent sound is the object of comprehension of a conception apprehending sound to be permanent. So, of course, those two conceptions of horns of a rabbit and apprehending sound to be impermanent are wrong consciousness in all schools. But here in Prasangika, they say that all minds are valid cognitions with respect to what's appearing to them, which is not really saying much, but that's what's being said here, is that of course, the conception of horns of a rabbit or sound to be impermanent are wrong consciousnesses. But for both of those, it's a valid cognition with respect to the appearance, because it's directly realizing the appearance, even though what the appearance is of, it doesn't exist. So it's not really saying much, but this is something that we see often in Prasangika, that for Prasangika, all minds are valid cognition with respect to their appearances, which is not saying a lot, but that's their assertion. So that's a little bit about valid cognition and so forth. Any questions about that? So again, the thing we need to bring out of Prasangika with respect to valid cognition, the differences, is valid cognition or pramana doesn't necessarily mean new, meaning subsequent cognition is also valid. And when they talk about this what's normally talked about as a direct perceiver or direct perception, that word in Sanskrit for Prasangika, we're more focusing on meaning the object, perceptible object, rather than the direct perceiver. So therefore, we can have a conceptual direct perceiver in that sense.
Okay. Could you just go over why a sense consciousness is necessarily mistaken?
Because Everything that appears to a sense consciousness appears to inherently exist, and it doesn't exist in that way. So a sense consciousness is not mistaken with respect to the fact that the flower exists, but it's mistaken with respect to how it exists. So it's mistaken because the way in which the object appears to sense consciousness is not how it exists. So it's mistaken in that way. But again, that doesn't make it a wrong consciousness, because it is valid with respect to establishing the existence of flower, but it is mistaken with respect to how that flower exists, because the flower appears to sense consciousness to inherently exist. So no lower school, even the Svatantrikas, say that that is not mistaken, because for Svatantrika, the flower does inherently exist, even though it doesn't truly exist.
Someone who's realized emptiness, they still
appear that way until they became enlightened. Because what we're going to see in the next section coming up is that for Prasangika, the cognitive obscurations are the latencies of ignorance and this mistaken appearance. So we only get rid of this mistaken appearance once we get rid of the cognitive obscurations, i.e. become a Buddha. So for everyone pre-Buddha, this is how things appear to them, in this mistaken way.
Is there something to do with the fact that we call it flower? You know, the perception. I mean, a bee or a bird doesn't see what we see, because it can see other spectrums of light and shape and colour. So we call that flower and we think that that exists like that, but to other minds, it doesn't.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And that's also for the Chittamatra system, they look at it in this way. But for them, for something to exist, it must truly exist from its own side. But the reality is there's these experiences. So then how to put those two ideas together for Chittamatra, they say, oh, therefore it must be internal to the mind, because we all have very different experiences and yet the thing we experience has to exist from its own side. So therefore, if it was external, that wouldn't be possible, this. We couldn't have those very different experiences because it would exist from its own side. So they say this is one of the reasons they use to say, well, therefore, it must be internal to our mind. But Prasangika, no. Prasangika, exactly the same line of thinking, they say, therefore, it can't exist from its own side because we have all very different experiences. Therefore, for us, we label flower. For other beings, they label food, home, shelter, whatever on that. Exactly. Okay, we've got 5 minutes before the break, so let's start on section 6, the way of asserting selflessness. So here again, let's look at the coarse and subtle selflessness chart. So the first sentence here says, the person being empty of being self-sufficient, substantially existent is accepted to be a coarse selflessness of person, and the person being empty of true existence is accepted to be the subtle selflessness of person. So this is different to all the lower schools, Vaibhashika, Svatantrika, Chittamatra, Svatantrika. So what we can see in this coarse and subtle selflessness chart is for all the lower schools, from Vaibhashika, Svatantrika, Chittamatra, Svatantrika, they all agree in that for them, coarse selflessness of person is grasping onto this permanent, unitary, independent self, and subtle selflessness of person is grasping onto self-sufficient self. Whereas here, Prasangika don't even really talk about this permanent unitary independent because it's not really of any relevance, because within Buddhism, that's only something that you would, it's not something you instinctively have. It's something you would only come to through some wrong intellectual way of thinking. So for Prasangikas, that's so coarse, it's not really of any relevance. Rather, what for them is coarse is grasping onto self-sufficient, substantially existent self, which we do instinctively have. So Prasangika agree with all the lower schools in that. They agree and say, yes, we do have this instinctive false sense of me. We're grasping onto self-sufficient, substantially existent self. How they differ from the lower schools is the lower schools say that if you realize that there's no self-sufficient, substantially existent self, you can be liberated. You'll achieve nirvana. Prasangika says no. Prasangika says, if you realize that, very good, very helpful. It will reduce a lot of your craving, attachment, aversion, be very helpful. It'll reduce a lot of your mental affliction, so it'll be a big help. But it won't get you out of samsara. Because for Prasangika, there's a more subtle, false way of grasping onto person. And that is grasping onto person to be inherently existent. So here in the text, of course, it says grasping onto person being grasping onto true existence. So for Prasangika, true existence is synonymous with inherent existence, existing from its own inside. So for Prasangika, the subtle grasping onto person is grasping onto an inherently existent person. So for them, if we want to achieve liberation, if we want to achieve nirvana, we need to eliminate that. So that's the difference here from the lower schools.
The lower schools have a different interpretation or difference between true and inherent existence.
Well, all lower schools, including Svatantrika, accept inherent existence.
Yeah.
Svatantrika, of course, negate true existence, but... So again... I had it here. Actually, maybe I've got some definitions for this. So maybe we'll look at that after lunch because it's lunchtime now. So what we'll do after lunch, again, to clarify terminology, and we'll use our modes of existence chart, and we'll use some definitions to help us clarify why Chittamatra, Svatantrika and Prasangika have different ideas about true existence, inherent existence, and so forth, what the meaning of them. So we'll throw in a few definitions and see how that, why they differ on those. But let's have some lunch first.